To you on Psalm 90. This week I want to speak to you on a miracle, and then next week I want to talk to you about a character, and then Easter Sunday comes, and then after Easter Sunday I want to get back to Matthew 13. So last Sunday a psalm, today my favorite miracle in the Old Testament, and then next week a character. Let me just say this about next week, parents as well. I will be speaking on Daniel in the morning service, and the Lord has led me to dovetail off of that Sunday evening. I want to talk about moral purity Sunday night, next Sunday night. And so I just wanted to give you a 7-day opportunity to encourage families. There's change, maybe if you can, maybe you don't normally attend. We have such wonderful attendance here, but I think it's important for us to talk about this very specific topic of moral purity, and I think it dovetails well on top of the foundation of Daniel chapter 1 that we'll be speaking on next Sunday morning. So that'll be next Sunday as we think about that as a church family. I think it'll be very important for us together. But today I'd like to speak about my greatest joy when it comes to a certain miracle of the Old Testament. That miracle is the Red Sea. And you said, Pastor, I thought you said turn to Psalm 103. I did. Because in Psalm 103, we find a verse of Scripture that opens up all of the working of God in the heart and in the life of Moses. And I want us to see here in Psalm 103, verse 7, it says this: He, that is God, made known his ways to Moses and his acts to the children of men. When you look at that verse, you almost feel like you could extract that verse out of Psalm 103 and just read Psalm 103 and go all the way through, and it almost looks like that verse is an interruption. But as you begin to let your mind dwell on this particular psalm, you begin to realize that this psalm is divided up, and specifically, it divides between verse 5 and 6. You know the first five verses where he says, Bless the Lord, O my soul, all that is within thee, bless his holy name, bless the Lord, O my soul. Don't forget all of his benefits, and he outlines them. He forgives. He heals, he redeems, he crowns. Verse 5, he satisfies. Verse 6, the Lord executes righteousness, justice for all who are oppressed. Verse 8, the Lord is merciful and gracious, slow to anger. And then you have this verse 7, just sort of stuck right here. And you look at verse 7 and you say, and how does this fit? The more you begin to meditate on verses number 6 all the way down to verse 19, you begin to see that David, who is the author of this psalm, according to the prescript, the Psalm of David, you begin to see that David is meditating on this idea, the benefits of the Lord. What's the greatest illustration that I could give of the benefits of the Lord? And the illustration is, I want to go to Moses. Because in the life of Moses, I see the greatest illustration of God forgiving, of God healing, of God redeeming, of God crowning, of God satisfying. Because for 40 years, as we learned last week, they're wandering. In the morning they get up, there's sun, and at night they go to sleep, there's sun and sand, at night they go to bed, and it's the moon in the sand. It never changes. Over 2 million people die in 38 years' time. Only two make it into the promised land who came through the Red Sea. Only two, Joshua and Caleb. And so their life could be a monotony, but as we learned last week from Psalm chapter 90 in the life of Moses, it's not a monotony when God assigns meaning to our days. And I think the way the Lord began to work in the most powerful of all miracles through the Red Sea, I think this is what is in David's mind as he is writing about the benefits of the Lord, and the illustration really comes from the life of Moses. In fact, verse number 8 is almost a direct quotation from Exodus 34 back in the life of Moses. I mean, his mind is thinking about the children of Israel as he thinks about the benefits of the Lord. But I notice in verse number 7, this statement, it says, He makes known His ways to Moses, to the children of men, or to the sons of Israel, His acts. There's a difference here. And you notice that the way here, He makes known His ways, Derek is the Hebrew term, it means a path or journey or road or a distance. Psalm 18:30, as for God, His Derek is perfect, His way, His path. His journey, his road is perfect. But notice it says in the text, but to the children of Israel, they only get to see his acts. You say, wow, I would love to see something like an event or a deed, like the Red Sea just opening up. If I could see that, I would never be the same. But there's something deeper than the act. It is the way. It's the derech. You see, the children of Israel were people who only, listen carefully, who only viewed God by what he did. Moses viewed God by who he is. And that's the chasm between Moses and the children of Israel. Most people are content to see some incredible, overwhelming, powerful display of God's providence. And they go, wow! But not Moses. In fact, in chapter 15 of Exodus, you have the Red Sea, chapter 14. Chapter 15, a song. At the end of chapter 15, you have the first complaining of the children of Israel. You say, isn't it enough to see the Red Sea open up and 2 million people go across and the Red Sea closes and in that womb, Pharaoh and his soldiers die? I mean, I'll never complain the rest of my life. Next chapter, complaining. You see, men and women, most of us want a display of God. We want to see God's events. We want to see God's acts. But that will never satisfy. In fact, so much so, Luke 16, a rich man and Lazarus die. Lazarus to the bosom of Abraham, and the rich man into Hades, and in torment. He lifts up his eyes and has a conversation. And in this conversation, he says, listen, I've got 5 brothers. Please, would you somehow send somebody back from the dead to tell my 5 brothers that they'll come to this place of torment? And Abraham said, no, we can't do that. And Abraham said this. He said, you see, they have the word. And if they won't believe the word, then they won't believe if somebody rose from the dead. Now think about that, men and women. If I could just see a display, if I could just show people how great and powerful God is, if I had some power evangelism, then surely people would just flock. No, they will not, because the people view God through his acts. Very few view God through his path. Moses was one of those. You see, the people saw the events of God, and powerful, yes, they were, but Moses saw the God of the event. The people saw the miracles of God. Yes, they were explosive and dynamic. Think of the plagues. Think of the Red Sea. Think of the manna every morning. Think of how they killed Amalek and his army. Think of all of the things that took place. Bitter water becoming sweet. Water out of a rock when there was no water. You see, they saw the miracles of God and they were dynamic. But Moses grasped the purposes of God. You see, the people saw the manner of God, his wonders to perform. But Moses saw God how he performed, the intricacies of the actual event itself. He understood not just the manner, but the method. This is why God does what he does. This is how God works. So whenever you look into the Old Testament and you look at the life of Moses, who was the greatest of all the Jews, Old Testament Jews, you have to understand it through the grid of verse number 7, that God made known his ways to Moses and his acts to the children of Israel. So let's see how that plays itself out. Turn back, if you will, to Exodus in chapter 14, which happens to be the Red Sea event. Exodus 14. When you come to this passage of Scripture, I'm reminded that most people are begging for the blessing of God. Moses is begging for God. Most want blessings. God, please help me because I'm struggling in my job. God, please help me because my finances are low. God, please help me because I'm having a real problem with my child. God, please help me because there's a situation and it's just overwhelming me. God, please help me because, and it's all about what God can do for you. But when's the last time you just had a time of prayer with God and just began to contemplate His character and contemplate who He is? And that just absolutely brought satisfaction to your soul. We are satisfied with the character and person of God, even if He allows us to go through a financial difficulty, even if He allows us to face death, even if He allows the doctor to say the words to us that we never want to hear, and we even prayed that God we'd never hear it. But we're so satisfied with God that He does not have to do any event for me to bring honor to Him. He only has to be Himself. And I'm satisfied. You see, when I look at this text is a real revelator. And we don't have time to go through the entire text verse by verse. So now you can breathe your sigh of relief because you looked at the very end and you said, oh man, 31 verses, they ain't even gotten to it yet. All right? But I will say this, that if you can grasp the first four verses, you're going to grasp the rest of the text. Now the Lord spoke to Moses saying, speak to the children of Israel that they turn, or your NIV text, or NASB update, or most of your texts will say they turn back and camp before Pi Hahiroth, between Migdol and the sea, opposite Baal Zephon. You shall camp before it by the sea. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. Then I will harden Pharaoh's heart, so he will pursue them, and I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. And they did so. The very first four verses unfold the plan of God. Here is the plan of God. In verse number 2, He says, I want the children of Israel to turn back. Now just stop and think about this, men and women. To turn back. They are making their exodus. That's what the word exodus means. It means to exit. They are making their exit. And as they make their exit, God says, wait a second, I want you to turn back. And God is very clear in His directions. I wish we could have a true map of this area to really pinpoint this, but it depends on what map you pick up. It's going to be where exactly that particular map is going to put these particular places. There are four places here. God says, I want you to turn back, and I want you to go to Pi Hahiroth, to Migdol. I want you to go to the sea which is opposite Baal Zephon, and I want you to camp by the sea. There are four markers that God gave to Moses, and these markers, I want you to live within these markers. And the markers are this, that you're going to turn back. You say, that's a paradox. It is a paradox. They're to exit. They are to go to the land of Palestine. They are to go to a place that God has prepared for them. And as they are to do this, God says, after coming out of the plagues and coming out of Israel, out of Egypt, and becoming a people who have exited from Egypt, God says, turn back. Go back. Verse number 3. Why? Verse 3 and 4. For Pharaoh will say of the children of Israel, they are bewildered by the land. The wilderness has closed them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart so that he will pursue them. And I will gain honor over Pharaoh and over his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. Remember Psalm 103? See, He's given the path to Moses. The path is this. I want to receive honor in a way that I have not received honor to this point. And here's what's going to happen. Verse number 3, God reads the heart of Pharaoh before they ever turn back. And God said, this is what Pharaoh is going to say. When he sees the children of Israel turning back, Pharaoh is going to say, these people are bewildered. They are perplexed. Same word in Esther 3:15, where Haman and the king sit down after sending out this edict to kill Jews. It says they sat down to drink, but the city of Shushan was perplexed. Same word. And so God is going to deal with Pharaoh, and he's going to do it this way. Another thing is this, is that when the children of Israel left, spies came also from Egypt to follow their movements. And so these spies go back and tell Pharaoh exactly what is taking place, because Pharaoh still had a heart that was extremely hard. And Pharaoh was going to say, when he saw the so-called bewilderment and perplexity and confusion, Pharaoh is going to say, I will pursue them, verse 4. And God said, but I am going to gain honor. I'll get the full weight, kavod. I'm going to have the full weight of glory rest upon me. I love what Durham writes in the Word Biblical Commentary in Exodus. This is what he says on page 187. Listen carefully. The fundamental point of this section, verses 1 to 4, is that Yahweh guides Israel in the Exodus. But he sets a puzzling route. No man would have thought of it. Yahweh's guidance must not be seen primarily as guidance from something, but instead as guidance towards something. In this section, it is guidance not towards Sinai or towards any other place, but toward a final great moment of victory over Pharaoh. So this is what God is doing. God is going to lead them to the land of Canaan. In fact, just look back, if you will, chapter 13, if you will, and look up to verse number 17. It came to pass, when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by the land of the Philistines, though this was near, for God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds. He knew how fickle they were. They see war return to Egypt. So God led the people around the way of the wilderness of the Red Sea, and the children of Israel went in orderly ranks up to the land, out of the land of Egypt. And Moses took the bones of Joseph with him, for he had placed the children of Israel under a solemn oath. That's Joseph. Had placed them under a solemn oath 400 years ago. God will surely visit you and will carry, and you shall carry up my bones from here with you. So they took their journey. You see, Joseph had also said 400 years ago, God is going to bring you to this land. You take my bones and you bury them in the land of Canaan. So make no mistake, God is going to take them from point A, Egypt, all the way to point B, into the land of Palestine, the land that he has promised them. But let me say to you, God is going to lead them in a paradoxical way, in a way that's going to bring him glory. And this is what frustrates Christians. Because we see point A, because that's where we are, and no one wants to be in Egypt. And then we see point B, the place of God's blessing there in Canaan. And so we are so focused on Canaan that if God does not give me a straight line from point A to point B, then there's something wrong with the compass of God. Because surely he doesn't want me to turn back and face Pharaoh. I just came out of there. And so the way God works is different than necessarily how you're thinking or I'm thinking. That's why you read in Psalm 103, verse 7, that God shows his way, his path. He shows the path to Moses. But the other 2 million people don't get it. And the way you know they don't get it is because they're going to complain in just a minute. So I want to challenge you that, folks, if you can get a hold of this section in the first four verses, then you begin to dig into the chapter in a way that you have not dug before. And you begin to look at the nuances of the chapter. And he moves from there, verse 5. And it was told the king of Egypt, the people had fled. He told them, the spies. And the heart of Pharaoh and his servants were turned against the people, and they said, why have we done this? Why did we let him go? That's what he's saying. Why did we let him go? So he made ready his chariot and took his people with him. Also, he takes 600 choice chariots. A chariot in that day would be like a tank. We're not really certain if it's a three-man chariot or a two-man chariot. We don't know. Or it could be a combination. The three-man chariot was the driver, the one holding the shield, and the one who was the archer. And they were quite significant and powerful things being pulled by a team of horses. But whether it was the three or the two, whenever you see the chariots on flat land and sand, they could go very quickly, very fast. They could mow people down. It would be something today like maybe a modern tank. When you see the tanks facing you and all you have is a little knife, you give up. All right? These people don't even have a weapon, and all of a sudden the tanks are coming. And he makes ready and is going to be led by Pharaoh himself. Verse 8, because the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and he pursued the children of Israel. And the children of Israel, he reminds them, had gone out with a high hand, had gone out with boldness. He reminds the children of Israel as they read this document, remember how we went out? Man, we were giving each other high fives and say, this is great. We never fired a shot and we're free. Great boldness, great confidence might be a better word. So, verse 9, the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army, and they overtook him, encamping by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth before Baal-Zephon. So here you have Pharaoh pursuing, and the way that he's going to pursue is he draws near, verse 10, and the children of Israel lift up their eyes, and they are extremely impressed, and then become distressed. They lift up their eyes, and can you imagine 600 chariots lined up in absolute pristine order? It is absolute perfect order with the armor shining and the sun shines on the armor. And as they come and the rumbling and the galloping and the brilliance of the sun as it sprays off of all of the armor and the equipment and beautifully polished in perfect formation. And the people look up having turned back, and all of a sudden things look a lot different than they did at the end of verse number 8. They went out with a high hand. Nobody's giving high fives now. In fact, notice what they do in verse 11. Then they said to Moses, Moses, you're a tremendous leader. We're so glad we followed you. Is that what it says? Verse 11. Moses, because there are no graves in Egypt, have you taken us out here to die in the wilderness? Why have you so dealt with us to bring us out of Egypt? Is this not the word that we told you in Egypt, saying, let us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? Really? Is that really what they said? Well, if you just go back and you begin to read through the text, you find out in chapter 1 and in chapter 2 of Exodus how they are saying, we need a deliverer. They are crying. God hears them. God sends Moses. But notice what they say. It would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die here in the wilderness. You see, let me say something to us men and women. This is exactly the strategy of Satan. It hasn't changed since this day and even in the garden. How does Satan come at us? He comes at it one of two ways. Number one, he comes at us and impresses us. That's why you read 1 John chapter 2, that we have the lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes and the pride of life. And so Satan will try to move us by an impression. It could be the beauty of the thing. It could be the sweetness of the thing. It could be the satisfaction of the thing. It could be that I am going to be here now rather than here. And so he is going to impress. Or he may distress. He may absolutely overwhelm you that you now are going to be tempted to go a direction that you would not gone otherwise. And it's interesting, whenever people are in a crisis, just listen to their words. And when you listen to their words, they will do exactly what these people did here. They rewrite their history. And now all of a sudden, things that did not matter before, now all of a sudden become very large and loom upon them, so that now in the crisis, they rewrite their own history, and it's not their fault, it's Moses' fault. And they never see the way of God. It would have been much better for me to stay in Egypt than to be facing 600 tanks. Now think of it. You see, that's the way we work, men and women. We rewrite history. We have a way of using our language and our mind to go back, and that's why people get upset with one another. And finally, have you ever sat two people down that were upset with one another, and you sit them down, and you finally get to the bottom of it, and the bottom of it is somebody just spilled a little bit of sugar and forgot to clean it up. And because the sugar was spilled, then all of a sudden, some tempers arose. And as the tempers arose, now it's no longer the sugar, but now it's that person. Look what they did to my kitchen. Look what they did to my space. Look what they have done. What have they really done? They spilled some sugar. But here's what happens. We rewrite history. And as we rewrite history now, it's no longer the sugar, it is that character. And we start to assassinate the character. And we start to elevate ourselves as we assassinate character. And now the sugar that's spilled, just a few, a few little grains, now has become an absolute solid fortress. And we're at war. And I'm going to win. You see, men and women, this is what Satan does. And usually, when we really get to the core issue, which takes forever to get to, the core issue is so much smaller. If we just dealt with it in a biblical way back there, we would not be up here fighting like we're fighting and rewriting history like we're rewriting history and elevating ourselves like we're elevating ourselves. Because the bottom line, men and women, is this. The people of Israel needed help. God sent help through the person of Moses. He's not a perfect man. But that's how God was going to send a deliverer. So when I note that it's very easy for us to find ourselves here because we become instruments of redactionist history, as we begin to elevate ourselves and to look at other people and to speak in an improper way. And the reason we're not there is because of him. Or the reason we're not here is because of her. Or the reason of this is because of that boss. And the reason of, and we never see the way of God. It's always paradoxical. It's never straight. It is always bends in the road. There's always turns. I mean, you just got to capture this. I spent the plane trip flying up, flying back. Got 4 hours from Detroit to California and then California to Detroit. So I spent those hours rereading Uncle Tom's Cabin. And it's quite an extensive book. But it's a fascinating book. You can hardly put it down. And how many of you can remember reading Uncle Tom's Cabin? Let me see your hands. Okay, there's a few of you. Okay, Harriet Beecher Stowe. I read it in high school, like you did, and I couldn't remember the names of the characters, and so I read this. And as I'm reading it, I'm really rooting for Tom, who has gone from owner to owner to owner. I'm rooting for his freedom. And then when he dies, at the end of the book, I'm saying, no, he can't do this. I want to rewrite this history. I would say that the effect of his life in that particular book was what the book is about. It's not necessarily about the life lived as a slave. It's about a life lived as a man who had integrity and the influence that it has. How is it that you smell perfume? You crush it. You take the bottle, you open it. The perfume does not smell until you take the lid off and begin to disseminate. How is it that you began to experience the incredible blessings of God? You will never experience until God says, okay, here's point A and here's point B. Here's where you are, here's where we're going to go. But before we get there, I'm going to smash you. I'm going to crush you. I'm going to put you face to face with someone that is so hard on you that you're going to be tempted to run. I'm going to put you face to face with a doctor who's going to give you some information that's going to make you doubt if God loves you. I'm going to put you in a situation so that you will be absolutely crushed. Because I will say this to you, men and women, very carefully I say this, knowing in my own life, that is this: God does not use people to their full until he absolutely crushes them. Then God uses people. He remakes them. It's the Jeremiah 18 passage where God takes Jeremiah and he notices how the potter is dealing with a clay pot, and Jeremiah watches under the direction of the Lord. As he's watching the potter, he notices that the potter is the flask is flawed. So he watches as the potter takes the flask off and he smashes it, and he doesn't discard it, but he then puts it back on the wheel and he remakes it to his own design. You see, that's the difficulty. And God says to him, when it comes to Israel and Judah, can I not do this with you? And that's the illustration for us. That's what God is going to do. He's going to put you on his wheel, and he's going to work this and frame it. And then there's these imperfections, and it's not easy, but God's going to take you off, and he's going to smash it. He's going to take you and put you back on the wheel, and he's going to begin to form you as he wants to form you. The problem we get so distressed by is that we see Pharaoh's army, we begin to judge ourselves by Pharaoh's army, or we look to our neighbor and begin to judge ourselves by our neighbor and say, I want to be like her. I want to be like him. I want to be impressive like them. I don't want them coming down on me. And we begin to make judgments on this lateral level. And we don't realize it's the way of God that our eyes should be focused. So when I look at this here, I see the enemy is pursuing. They're coming down. And what does Moses say in verse 13? And Moses said to the people, and I love these three terms, stop being afraid, stand still, see the salvation of the Lord. He's going to accomplish for you today. The Egyptians who you see today, you're never going to see them again. The Lord's going to fight for you. Would you please be quiet? That's pretty strong language. But that's exactly why in my prayer, I prayed taking Daniel's prayer and said, I think us as God's people, we're so busy rewriting history in our mind and so busy building our own mountain that we've lost the point. We've lost the point. So when I look at the text here, Moses is saying to them, who's going to do the fighting? Not you. Verse 14 tells you, the Lord will do the fighting. Okay? It's the Lord who said, turn back. It's the Lord who said, this is what's going to happen. It's the Lord who said, I want the full weight of glory on my name and on my shoulders and not on Pharaoh. And so the people don't understand it because the people don't understand the path of the Lord. They do everything by what they can see with their visible eye. How many plagues do you have to see before you say, okay, God, I get it. You're in control. How many do you have to see? God gave him 10. How many do you have to see? How many do I have to see before we all of a sudden wake up and say, oh, yeah, I get it. God is in control. Well, then, when you hear the news, would you just be quiet? Would you just be quiet? Would you just stop being afraid? Would you stand still? Would you hold your tongue and see what God is going to do? Because guess what? God is going to do something. And that's I remember the first time I got on Apollo's chariot. You remember this? You remember this at Busch Gardens? Get on Apollo's chariot? And you're up here. It took me about 17 times, I think, before I take a hand off of the bar, okay? My wife is like this, but I'm like this. I'm a pastor. I've got to come preach, so I got all these little reasons why. But you go up and you start, and it starts to go up and it goes slower and slower. And then, my wife says, look over there. And I look over there. It's a long way down there. People look like little pygmies walking around down there. And isn't this fun? And then you get to the top. And when you get to the top, I just, people's hands go up in the air, knuckleheads. They just put their hands up in the air. Me, I sing Nearer My God to Thee. That's what I do. It wasn't until last year for the first time I did Alpengeist. First time. And I'm telling you, there is something that is just so incredibly amazing about those rides that my mind goes to with me personally when I think of what God wants to do. I mean, could you imagine the Red Sea opening up and the water standing straight up and 2 million people walk across? I mean, so what's God going to do in your life? I don't know. But let me tell you something. Stop being afraid, stand still, and keep your mouth shut. How's that? Is that plain? It is to me. And I have to continue to look in the mirror, and Pastor Jim reminded us, this is self-talk. I'm not looking at you. I'm sitting right down here in his chair. I'm saying, Daniel Davey, keep your mouth shut. Stop being afraid. Stand still. Watch God do what he's going to do. Because you know what? I want to see his way. I want to see his path. Then what happens? Well, verse 15 begins the story. And I have 3 minutes. I told you I wouldn't get through all of it. But I would say this to you, that when you begin to read, I love how it begins verse 15. After all of this is done, what would you do if you were God? I know what I would do. If I were God, I would say, now, everybody, you're quiet? Finally. Okay, watch. Now, you watch what I'm going to do. But that's not how it begins in verse 15. There's a little exercise that God's going to put his people through. Verse number 15. And the Lord said to Moses, why are you crying to me? Tell the children of Israel to do what? There you go. To go forward? I mean, tell the people, line up, get in line, get in order. And now when we're going to go forward. And all of them are looking at each other. Go forward, okay? Forward. Water. Now stop and think about this. So Moses lines them up. Nobody knows what's going on. Moses says, just keep your mouth shut and line up. And I think if Moses was angry, have you ever seen an 80-year-old man with a long beard and a rod get angry? Well, he got angry. Line up. Let's do this. And they line up. And notice what happens. He lifts up the rod. Verse 19. Meanwhile, behind them, because if they're going forward, that means they have to turn away from what they're looking at. They're looking this direction as Pharaoh's coming with his tanks. So now they got to turn around and look away from Pharaoh, and they've got to look at the water in front of them and go forward. To the behind them are all these chariots. So here's what God does in verse 19. The angel of the Lord who went before the camp of Israel moved and went behind them with a pillar of cloud before them and stood behind them. And it comes between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. There's a cloud and darkness to the one and the light by night to the other. You know why God wants light? He wants them to turn. And when they turn, even though it's dark and it's night and they can't see back here, he has it just as light as it possibly can, and their mouth is wide open as they watch the water just, and the wind just, and the ground become solid, and nobody is moving. And then the text says, verse 22, the children of Israel go into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall. They're a wall to them. And they're on the right and left. I've thought about this. You know, it's probably a good thing I wasn't one of those kids. You know, my mom's very thankful, I'm sure. Because if it's a wall, that means a fish are coming up to that. And I know what I would do if I was looking at that wall. I'm looking this way and that way, boom, you know, to see if it would happen. Could I put my hand in it? Could I grab me a fish? Could I bring it out? Mom, look what I've got. Put it back, you know. Just stop and think and let your mind have some fun with that. But I'll tell you this, men and women, in all seriousness, there's a wall on either side of them. Just think of this. And the people walk through. And it comes to pass, verse 23, I think verse 23 is one of the most incredible verses. The Egyptians, now God allows the light to shine, and the Egyptians pursue after them in the midst of the sea. You ever want a verse on how sin blinds the intellect? It's absolutely blinding. I mean, would you go, if you were chasing someone and this happens, I mean, would you do this? And it comes to pass, the Lord looks down as the army's right in the middle. And he troubles the army of the Egyptians. I love what it says here. He takes off their chariot wheels. So they drive them with difficulty. That's an understatement. Try driving a chariot without wheels. And finally they say, let's get out of here because the Lord fights for them. And then the Lord said to Moses, stretch your hand over the sea, the waters come back, the Egyptians and their chariots and their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand, and when the morning appeared, the sea returned to full depth. But don't forget the rest of the verse. So the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea, and the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the army of Pharaoh, and the sea came after them. Not one of them remained, and the children of Israel walked on the dry ground. Why? Because the waters were a wall. Now look at verse 30. And the Lord saved Israel that day out of the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. Josephus writes, this is how Moses outfits the children of Israel with spears and bows and all the different kind of equipment. Now, I don't know if that's true or not, but I'll tell you one thing. God did not want to keep the Egyptians submerged, but they're expelled as the force of this wall comes down, just absolutely destroys it and expels these people onto the ground. And the children of Israel just go by and collect all of the armor that they could possibly need. That's Josephus. Verse 31 says, and when Israel saw the great work the Lord had done, the three things happened. Number one, they feared the Lord. Number two, they believed the Lord. 15:1. They sang this song to the Lord. What happens? They fear, they believe, they sing. Let me just give you a couple of thoughts and conclude when I look at this. What do I see? If you really want to know God, men and women, if you really want to know God, then don't look to the events in your life. Why do you get depressed? Because look what's happening to me. Get your eyes off yourself. Don't look at the events of your life. Look to His ways. Remember the word Derek? Psalm chapter 18, David writes, as for the Lord, His Derek is perfect. His way is perfect. Look to the way, not to the event. I would say, secondly, unless your God is the God of Moses and Israel at the Red Sea, you don't have a God. Unless this God, who is Moses' God, is your God, you do not have anything worth called a God. It is no wonder that the writer of Hebrews in chapter 3 says, okay, let's compare Jesus with Moses. Moses was worthy of honor, but Jesus is worthy of greater honor. Why is that? Because Moses is part of the house. Jesus, as the Son, is over the house. Who lives within you? Not Moses. Christ. And if Jesus Christ is your focus, if Jesus Christ is your God, that means you have submitted to Him. He is master. You are slave. You are committed to Him. I am committed to Him. I have a great God. I would say, thirdly, that God is fully capable of taking care of His people. But He's going to do it His way and in His time. What if God chooses death? What if God chooses pain? What if God chooses difficulty? Is it because His derrick, His way, has got some ruts in it and some faults in it and some cavities in it? Is that why? Or is it because we're looking for the blessing? We're begging God for an event. And God says, look to me. God is fully capable of taking care of every single one. He's fully capable of making every person in here a millionaire. He's fully capable of making every person here strong and healthy. He's fully capable of having all of you live to be 100 years old. That's not God's way. God's way is not that you be healthy and wealthy and happy and live a long life. God's way is that you be holy, that you be like Him, that you, when you're in the way, it's not about your life, it's about your influence, it's about your legacy. It's about the greatness of God, because God wants the full weight of His glory to rest in His name, not in your life. But if your life will allow the world to see His glory, it's a success, and God will reward you for that. Another one. Whatever God does, it's always for the purpose of manifesting His glory. Oh, I don't care what's happening in my life, your life, it's always for one single reason, and that is to manifest His glory. And I will not, Isaiah says, I will not give my glory to another. And whenever God works, God's people need to do three things. One, we need to do what the text says. Fear Him, believe Him, sing to Him. There it is. We're not going to write a book about how great I am and look at what's happened in my life. What we're doing is coming to the Lord and saying, God, I want to see Your way. And I'm going to be like Moses in chapter 33 of Exodus. I want to be like Moses who said, God, if Your presence doesn't go with me, don't take me another step. God, here's what I want to do. I want to be with You. And that's exactly how we began last Sunday morning. Lord, I want to make You my dwelling place. So when I look at the text, I say to you, aren't you glad we serve this kind of a God? Aren't you glad it is this God that we serve? It's not a false God. It is the true, the living, the wonderful God. We sang, to begin this, we sang, Be Unto His Name. And I chose that song, but I also only used one verse. So what I'd like us to do is I'd like us, in light of chapter 14 of Exodus, I'd like for us to sing this song, Be Unto It. So let's stand together. Matt, would you come? Meredith, would you come? As they come, we're going to sing this particular song, because these words absolutely encapsulate everything that we've talked about. To the name of the Lord, we give all honor and all glory. So as you sing these two verses, and chorus with it, as you sing together, sing from your heart. If this is your testimony, if not, just confess. Just confess. Say, God, I am rewriting my own history. I'm not happy with Your way, and that's sin. And I acknowledge this before You. It is Your way. It's not my way. And from that posture, you can indeed sing this song, Be Unto His Name. Let's sing together.